Hello, I'm Vantone Quinlevin, CEO of Futuro Health, welcoming you to Workforce RX, where I interview leaders and innovators for insights into creating a future-ready workforce. We're going to take a look today at a part of the U.S. workforce that faces perhaps more challenges than any other, formerly incarcerated individuals. The headwinds they face in finding employment include social stigma, legal barriers, and lack of up-to-date skills, which explains an unemployment rate of over 27% for this population. To learn more about what is being done to support people in this circumstance, we're joined by Sam Schaefer, CEO of the Center for Employment Opportunities. The center is the nation's largest reentry employment organization with a presence in 30 cities across 12 states and has been a trailblazer in providing comprehensive employment services with a focus on reducing recidivism through work. Mr. Schaefer brings deep expertise in politics, policy, and workforce development to the role, which he has held since 2009. Thanks very much for joining me today, Sam.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be chatting with you.
Well, we would love for you to start by adding to that very brief sketch of this challenging issue. What can you share with our listeners?
I think it's important to set the context for the criminal justice system and the challenges that people face when they come home. So across the United States, there's approximately 1.2 million people in state correctional facilities. 95% of those individuals will eventually come home. That's pretty much everybody. And when folks come home, they're often returning to communities with a high sense of optimism, an eagerness to reengage with their families, to reengage in civic life, to find a job to support themselves. And it's that very moment where there is such enthusiasm, where there is such strong positive energy, where they're going to face some of the most significant barriers, right? For someone coming home, they need to often connect with a parole probation officer who's going to give them a handful of conditions that they have to meet that can often be tremendous stumbling blocks. They're going to have to find housing. They're going to have to be able to secure some of the just basic needs, food and transportation. And so very quickly, we run into this dynamic where the hundreds of thousands of people who come home every year with that energy, with that enthusiasm and excitement are just straight up into the barriers of reentry. And it's, depressing, and it's a sad comment on sort of the support we don't give people that, most what we call failure would happen in the first 90 days, right? Most recidivism, people being rearrested, reincarcerated, happens early because of that failure to give folks the support. And so for the better part of 25, 30 years, there's been a much more accepted notion that reentry matters, right? If we don't support people, we do it at our own peril. If we do it at the peril for the individual success, we also do it at the peril for public safety. There's lots of barriers, which I'm sure we'll get into in terms of how we scale evidence base and solid reentry work. But I think that's sort of an important starting point, right? A lot of people coming home, high enthusiasm, energy, and lots of barriers from day one.
And so give us an overview, Sam, of the CEO's approach, and the CEO stands for the Center for Employment Opportunities, and how it's designed to work from day one of reentry.
Based on these challenges, right? Again, that first 90 days being so critical, based on the need for people to have a sense of hope and direction from day one, our approach is to engage people in the week, sometimes just days immediately after release. And so we work really closely with community organizations. We work really closely with probation and parole to encourage people to come to CEO as soon as possible post-release. And our program model, which has been validated through multiple independent evaluations to both increase employment and reduce recidivism, is standardized across the 30 cities, 12 states in which we work. We give everyone access to a very brief paid orientation. It's 2 days. It's as much an onboarding to a job as anything. After those 2 days, which involve some of the basics of on work behaviors, some of the basics of on safety, every single person who comes to CEO, that's over 8,000 people a year, begins to work for us. So we run what's called a social enterprise. That social enterprise generates contracts, principally with public sector agencies, that allows us to deploy teams, which we call work crews, to provide basic labor and maintenance. And so, for instance, across the state of California, we have a large scale relationship with Caltrans, providing roadside litter abatement and other landscaping services. This means that someone, sometimes just a few days home from prison, is working for CEO. They're learning the basic work skills that they need to be successful in any job, but also, and this is really critical, we're paying them, and we're paying them every day. We're trying to make that intentional connection between the effort they're exhibiting, showing up to a, you know, a demanding job, and being compensated for it, right? While also giving them that income that they really do need to survive and be successful. So someone at CEO works on our social enterprise on average for 3 to 4 months. Concurrent with that experience, they're also receiving case management. And so what we're able to say is that someone is earning a daily paycheck. They're also getting prepared for a full-time job outside of CEO. And again, you know, while that average is 3 or 4 months, there could be someone who's coming home. They've completed their associate's degree. They have some previous work experience, and they might get a job quite quickly. Whereas some of our folks, you know, half of whom have never worked before in the formal economy, might need a little bit more time, might need a little bit more coaching, right, to get that full-time job. We then follow up with folks once they're placed in a full-time job for an additional 12 months, providing them retention services, helping them engage in more skill training to get, you know, jobs that help them move up in the labor market.
What an impressive model. So I heard some key words in there. The fact that you can secure these contracts that allow these individuals to be paid. So that's the second key word, that there's training component, there's case management, not only during those 3 to 4 months, but another 12 months. Now, that model must have been iterated many times over the years. What were some of the big learnings along the way that led you to this combination of success factors?
It's such a great question. Every workforce program wishes they could hit it out of the park on day one and, you know, land on the model that would be immediately responsive to folks' needs. You know, and I think to your question, not only has it been iterated on, but we continue to have to iterate on it. But I'll go back and answer some of the question of some of the big evolutions. I describe basically four phases of the model, right? Orientation, paid transitional work, job coaching, job placement. You know, so those three components. We didn't have job retention at CEO, you know, 20 years ago. We didn't have these dedicated services to help people keep their jobs. The workforce was much more geared towards immediate placement, getting people just into jobs rather than helping them keep the jobs. Contracts didn't support and pay for that type of work. And it's no surprise, and it was really exposed during our first randomized control trial, that, you know, we were seeing these big increases in employment in year one, right? So people are coming to CEO, they're working at high rates in the transitional job, they're getting placed, and then it's falling off. And if you didn't have retention services, it's not a huge surprise. But having that evidence was so critical to validate the need to invest, you know, first with philanthropy and then make the case to government that investing in 180-day, 365-day retention, upskilling of folks was absolutely critical for this population. You know, we were seeing people at the time not go back to prison, but not achieve economic mobility, right? And so there was some behavior change happening, which was really positive, but we don't want people, you know, to live life struggling in poverty, even if they're not back in prison. So that was a huge evolution for CEO.
And can I ask a clarification? So when you talk about job retention services, what does that look like to the individual?
It's a handful of things. It is one-on-one engagement. You know, I can't support you if I'm not talking to you about your challenges. Again, you know, the folks who come to CEO, half have never worked before. At the very least, many have been years removed from the labor market. So some of these basic work success factors, right, just being able to communicate with your coworkers and peers can be the difference between keeping a job and losing a job. You know, I can't tell you how many times we've helped coach someone through a dynamic where, you know, there's a childcare issue, so they would need to be almost consistently 15 minutes late to the start time of a job 2 or 3 times a week. And if that actually is communicated to the manager, to the organization, there's often things, accommodations that can be made, especially for a strong employee. If you don't have the confidence, if you don't have the skills to one, identify that challenge and then proactively address it, it can result in job loss. That is an example, can be a core function of a retention specialist who's, you know, providing that case management.
Are those retention specialists someone with lived experience who was formerly incarcerated? Is that part of their background?
It may be. I mean, we find great, great success with people who have been participants at CEO, bring their lived experience and their expertise to bear on our case management work in particular. Not exclusively so, but it's really important. I mean, I would also add that one of the functions here that can be really important is just to be able to deal with job loss when it does occur and get someone immediately re-engaged. So again, you know, this may be a first job. It may not be the best fit. The employer might be contracting. If we can stay in close contact with somebody, what we can do at CEO is get them back working on our social enterprise, right? So there's no interruption in pay. There's no deflation and sort of progress, right? So, you know, all right, you were at CEO, you were working for 3 or 4 months, you were placed, maybe you lose a job in 4 months, come back and work for us, right? While we look for another job and replace it. That's really critical. And the final thing I would say on retention that's been really helpful is, you know, we give cash incentives. It's a twofold function. It's first to engage people, right? Because we can't solve the challenge unless we're talking to. So, you know, if you can show us a pay stub at certain key milestones, right? We will give gift cards, checks to folks, which helps engage them. But also it's like, it's encouraging, it's motivating, right? You know, it's a thing that we think people really have earned and deserve at this point, given the tremendous strides they've made.
That's so clever. And then tell us some more about the paid work part. How did you come to structure those contracts and convince the public entities to be able to award those contracts?
Yeah, you know, when I came to CEO, I didn't know much about public sector procurement. And now it's become, you know, it's not the topic that, you know, I always want to bring up at cocktail parties or, you know, at someone's barbecue, but it's a fascinating and absolutely critical part of the work that we do, and so important. And so I used the example earlier of Caltrans, but, you know, other examples of our partners, you know, public housing authorities, parks departments on the city, county level, state parks departments, and so many more, you know, are looking for supplemental labor that's highly flexible, that can do tasks that are necessary for the functioning of a state, city, or county. And it's really interesting. I mean, you know, using the transportation example, a state DOT, and I think we work with 8 state DOTs around the country, a state DOT does not have a criminal justice budget, but they have a maintenance budget. And that's really been one of the keys to CEO scaling is to, you know, go in and make the case that you need this work. We can provide it in a cost-effective way. We act then as the conduit to pay folks, you know, with our daily payroll. And many of these partnerships that we've had predate even my time at CEO, you know, and it really is a testament to the amazing work that our supervisors and social enterprise crew members are doing every day that, you know, once we're in and people see how strong the work is, it is very, very rare for us to not have that be a multi-decade relationship.
Was there any other learning that you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, I think, you know, on this issue of public sector support for reentry, I mean, I may be jumping ahead to questions that you would have later on, but I think it's this really interesting dynamic where, you know, it's really hard to scale reentry employment. There isn't dedicated funding across federal sources, or isn't dedicated, you know, state to state. It can really vary in terms of, you know, what resources are available. And so CEO's ability to generate earned revenue from these diverse sectors that, again, don't have dedicated criminal justice funding has been really the key to our scaling. You know, it's about 40 to 45% of our total revenue comes from these work crew contracts. You know, if we were trying to just scale and support our work through government grants and philanthropy, it simply wouldn't be possible for our work. There, you know, there is not enough resources in this dedicated space for reentry employment, period, but certainly not to do what we're doing every day.
Well, it's such a brilliant set of concept that came together. Congratulations. So you talked about the first job back being so pivotal in the reentry journey. Are there any other elements that you'd like to highlight or stories you'd like to highlight to give the listeners a feel for the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think one piece that's really important to note is, like, you know, what is in that first job and what are people's expectations? We have a lot of folks who might come through the door and have a mental model of what's possible and think, you know, okay, like, based on my conviction and maybe my limited work history, I think I can work only in these jobs, right? And I think one of our responsibilities as providers is to help break that mental model. When we really go deep with people, I can't tell you how often there is a profound sense of wanting to give back, wanting to connect with civic life in a positive way. And so, you know, I'm thinking of so many people, but one gentleman in particular that I've participated on a number of panels with who came through CEO, name is Dion Johnson. It was this notion, right? Like, I want to be engaged in my community. I want to be politically active. I want to have a job that gives me meaning. And so how do we figure out how to meet people where they are and their real wants? And sort of say, yeah, like there's much more, you know, by all means, like if it's logistics work or it's construction work that you find meaning in, that's fantastic. But if it's something different, let's also find that space. And so, you know, one thing that CEO developed in the last several years is something called we call it internally our Emerging Leaders Program, where every department within our organization, from our program delivery teams to legal and compliance to finance, IT, host 12-week-long internships for people coming who are in our program. And it has this amazing dual function. First, it ensures that a department like IT has someone with lived experience, right, in their department. I can't tell you how much that's informing their decision-making, you know, how we structure our CRM, how we structure our technology systems, making sure that they're aligned with the needs and desires of folks is critical. But for the beneficiaries, right, this experience is so important. It's showing them what working in a nonprofit is like, all the ups and downs of our sector. It's giving them a real path to get a job that can give back in a way that's meaningful to them. And for Dion, where Dion started was getting involved in some of our policy work. He worked in our policy department, advocating for legislation across New York State. And now he's doing incredible messenger work in a hospital in New York City. And, you know, just finds such great value and meaning in that work.
And Sam, how do the individuals get coached or get supported to navigate the fact that they are formerly incarcerated in terms of the job market? I mean, there's so many barriers in the job market right now. And so once they do the 3 to 4 months as an employee of the CEO, how do they navigate the job market they go into?
Yeah, we're using that 3 or 4 months with our continuous coaching to prepare mm-hmm. them for those challenges that may occur. Preparing people that hiring managers still often hold significant stigmas against convictions. How can they best address their conviction in a transparent and open way is a critical part of that coaching. It's almost invariably going to come up at some point in the interview process. And there can be a great answer that people have about how, you know, they made a mistake, they've done great work in the past, and they're really motivated and excited to be re-engaged in the labor market. And this is a great fit for them. And that's just one element of the coaching that people will face. But I think the workforce has changed as well. So even if you did have work experience prior to your incarceration, you are likely entering a labor market that's just profoundly different. Even just the way we fill out applications, everything is going to be online. Many of the folks we're now working with are digitally native, so that doesn't present quite the challenge, but making sure that they're doing that effectively and accurately, you know, and being coached through how to get an online submission in a way that's going to best present themselves is absolutely critical for that preparation.
So it sounds like the coaching can help them once they get the interview, but how do they even get past the applicant tracking process, which does such an automatic job of screening people out?
It's so interesting. If I go back 16 years ago, when I started working at CEO, our core employers were small and medium-sized businesses where we could talk to the hiring manager directly, where our job developers, which we now call business account managers, right? They could pick up the phone and say, hey, I got a great applicant. This person is working for CEO. They've been with us for 3 or 4 months. They're getting great reviews from the supervisor. You know, they're able to build that trust, show them an applicant. And if we fast forward 16 years later, it's so interesting. There's a lot more enthusiasm and openness from large employers, right? Sort of through fair chance hiring commitments. We've seen companies like JP Morgan take really impressive leadership roles, right? And saying that we want to be second chance employers. And at the same time, it's still absolutely so much easier for us when we can still pick up the phone and call the hiring manager. And so it still keeps us in that sort of small to medium sized business range. So we've seen some evolution where just more, you know, applicant tracking systems will see people through, but it does exist as a barrier. And it's not just a barrier for those individuals, it's a barrier to scaling reentry employment more generally, right? If we're only able to work in certain sectors with certain size businesses, that is really limiting the opportunities of folks. And so I've seen some, you know, really good progress on this front. You know, again, with large businesses, Second Chance Business Coalition, right? You know, trying to work with Fortune 100 companies to change their hiring practices. But I think we need to see more in that domain. We need to see more companies making these commitments and not just reducing barriers, but also proactively trying to recruit folks who have convictions, because it's often very hard for them to even know that they can get even their foot in the door or their application read.
So, Sam, where would you like to take the CEO and all of your good works right now? I mean, what's on the horizon for you?
It's a great question. And, you know, for many years, CEO's goal was to grow and expand. You know, we started providing services just in New York City across the five boroughs. It was these randomized control trials and evaluations that were showing that we were having an impact in reducing recidivism and increasing employment that gave us the confidence that we could grow. And it was also responding to the need. You know, I remember 15 years ago traveling around the country and just not appreciating the lack of coordinated reentry services in so many communities and the high demand for our services. And so that led us to a multi-year strategy that really focused on the expansion of our model. That's what, you know, helped us get into work in 12 states, you know, working in 30 cities, was we had this financially sustainable model for which there was a significant demand because, again, you know, there's really a lack of coordinated reentry funding. As we think about the next phase for CEO and the next phase for reentry, we could continue to grow. You know, I could see a scenario in which CEO was in 60 cities, you know, in 24 states. And that would be great, right? I think we could serve a lot more people. But again, you know, if we go back to the 600,000 people coming home every year and CEO serving 8,000, I don't think it can or should be a single organization who is providing these services. Individuals coming home should have choice. We may very well not be the program for everyone, right? You know, I think workforce development generally is most effective when there is a multiplicity of programs, a multiplicity of options for job seekers. And the reentry space more generally, what I think we have a responsibility, I even say at CEO, to do is share some of these lessons, right? How do we not just scale our organization, but scale the field of reentry? How do we bring more public sector dollars into this space? So, you know, it could be a local organization in Memphis growing. It could be a statewide organization in Illinois growing. I can give you some specific examples here. For instance, one source of federal money that's just vastly underutilized right now is called SNAP Employment and Training. It's a source of dollars that supports people who are on nutrition benefits find upskilling opportunities, and it goes directly to nonprofits. It has been expanded in recent years to support paid learning opportunities like CEOs. So one of our big missions is how do we expand SNAP E&T, not just for CEO, right, but to states that are not maximizing its drawdown? How do we get more money into the field? And so I think really the evolution for us in the coming years is not so much growing. We're going to grow at CEO. We're going to open a handful of more offices I'm excited about. But really, how do we grow the field of reentry? How do we go to a place where in the top 100 cities across this country, in terms of population, someone coming home from prison can expect to have one or two or three great options to help find jobs through nonprofits?
When I was with the California community colleges, there were always periodic grants that came to the community colleges to work with this population. I'm wondering aloud about your methodology, how you think about the coaching, the paid work, all the above, the case management, just like we talked about, being able to share your model, the comprehensive model, what it really takes for someone to land and get back on their feet. Because just the training component is just a subset of all the things that you had mentioned.
That's right. I mean, there is often a multiplicity of needs. We talked about this at the very beginning, you know, whether it's housing or connecting with family or dealing with an outstanding civil fine or penalty or dealing with probation or parole. And so that requires folks, you know, even if your primary or even your stated exclusive orientation is workforce development, if those barriers exist to finding employment, you can't be successful without addressing them. Right. And so that could be everything as simple as helping someone find interview clothes to something much more complex, which, you know, helping their child enroll in daycare or helping them, you know, submit housing applications and coordinate their living arrangements. Because yes, we want everyone to work and have the autonomy and agency that comes with employment. But if there are these barriers standing in the way, it's just not going to be successful. And those have to be addressed first.
So let me pull some of the threads that you mentioned about scaling. So for all those who are listening and want to scale their impact and good services, it sounds like the randomized controlled trials, as well as the figuring out the sustainable business model was sort of the two key components required for you to scale. I was wondering if you could talk about how you approached the randomized controlled trials, because then some of your clients couldn't benefit from the services.
That's right. I mean, these are incredibly challenging evaluations, right? And so we've done two, and we've done a handful of quasi-experimental evaluations. And, you know, the first randomized control trial, which actually the enrollment predated my time coming to CEO, but I know from the organizational leaders at the time that the reason they engaged in it was just wanting to know. You know, it's actually really important to recognize, and in the criminal justice space, there have been interventions, right, which are intuitive, which seem common sense, which have actually backfired and created more problems than they've solved. And so I think that there's a really strong ethic for engaging in these types of evaluations to make sure that the work you're doing, that you're pouring your heart into every day, is actually working and at the very least not doing harm, right? And so I say that because they can be incredibly challenging depending on where you randomize that individual. And so in CEO's first RCT, the randomization was at the front door. And so people who came in, and there was such an over enrollment challenge, right? There's so many people who wanted CEO services. And so ethically, we couldn't accommodate everyone at the time. And so some people got a control group, which was a modified set of services, and some people got the full program experience at CEO. That's really hard. That was incredibly hard for staff, as I understand it, to see people who were counting on this program and weren't able to fully participate. At the same time, it allowed us to understand that we were actually doing good work. But these are the very real trade-offs and the very hard conversations that organizations have to go in when looking at evaluations. We've done a subsequent RCT that did the randomization actually prior to release. It had its own set of challenges methodologically, because it meant we had to try to find people post-incarceration, convince them to come to the program, and sort of raise questions around what was voluntary and not. But the questions around evaluation are not to be taken lightly. One thing that we did in subsequent years was form an evaluation advisory board to give us outside expertise on, you know, what are the key questions? How are we ensuring that we're doing it ethically?
And then any thoughts or learnings from developing your sustainable revenue model?
So many thoughts. It's hard, you know, for any nonprofit, it's hard. And I think we're sitting in a space right now at a moment that is, I recognize, is so challenging for so many organizations. And, you know, I fear that some of the challenges may be just emerging. CEO did quite well in the last two downturns, 2009 recession and post-COVID, really because there was a government and philanthropic safety net that helped support us. We saw actually some of our first big scaling grants come in the 2009-2008 recession because, you know, providing workforce services is a whole lot cheaper than incarcerating people, right? So the states were sort of seeing this, like, okay, let's get on board this train. It's a cost savings mechanism. Similarly with COVID, the philanthropic response was tremendous. You know, it's too soon to tell, but if we face real strains on state budgets in the coming years, I just don't know what that safety net looks like. And that's much more up in the air right now. And so I know your question was about a sustainable economic model. I just want to acknowledge that for organizations like CEO who've achieved that to some degree today, I think it's going to require a lot of creativity, a lot of iteration, and a lot of evolution in our funding models potentially in the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, I'm cheering on the CEO. I don't know if you know this, Sam, but I was actually back in the private sector, which was like two sets of careers ago, had first learned about the CEO at the Clinton Global Initiative. So I'm so glad to be interviewing you now.
Oh,
yes,
fantastic.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I remember that event. That's awesome.
Keep up the good work. All right. So let's end today by giving you the opportunity to just say what gives you the most hope about where the reentry movement is headed and where CEO fits into that future.
You know, where I'm most excited is that, you know, I think I made reference to this earlier, that reentry has established itself as a key component of the justice system. It is no longer questioned. Doesn't mean that, you know, states, philanthropy always fund it to the levels that we think is appropriate, but we're not at a place where in recent years we've seen backsliding of that, you know, this doesn't work or this isn't the right approach. which is really encouraging because, you know, in the broader criminal justice space, there has been a lot of shifting attitudes and concerns around different sentencing reforms or bail reforms. But reentry has, you know, really solidified its place as a key component. Everyone just about is going to come home. Let's support them. So to me, that gives us such an important foundation to build on, even in a moment where government and philanthropic funding might be less secure. It gives us the foundation to launch a really ambitious plan that would say, let's build a national reentry infrastructure where if you're coming home to any community in this country, you can and should expect that there's a quality job training program for you. And that's an incredibly bold vision. But I think the progress we've made collectively, not just CEO, but all the advocates, all the policymakers, you know, all the on the ground workers providing the job coaching every day have shown that this works, right? To the extent that we can now be bold in our thinking. And I'm really excited about that.
Well, we want you to be bold, Sam. Your work is so good, and we want to see the organization continue to have its fantastic impact. Thank you very much, Sam, today for being with us and just sharing your wisdom and learnings and best practices with our listeners.
It was an absolute pleasure to be in conversation with you today.
I'm Vantone Quinlevin with Futuro Health. Thanks for checking out this episode of Workforce RX. I hope you will join us again as we continue to explore how to create a future-focused workforce in America.